In 2020, 49-year-old Jamie Faith was literally gunned down outside his home in Texas. His wife, Jennifer, was utterly traumatized and heartbroken. She too was assaulted. The couple had been happily married for 15 years. In televised interviews, she spoke about the wonderful and caring man her husband had been. She pleaded for information that could lead to the perpetrator being arrested. Investigators were blindsided. They couldn't understand how a man so loved by so many had been murdered so brutally, seemingly without any explanation. This is the case of ultimate betrayal. This is the murder of Jamie Faith. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today, before I start, I am going to talk about my book. So a lot of you have asked for a very long time whether I've written books before, if you can buy the books I've written, and the reason you haven't been able to is because I haven't written any. However, I signed a 2-book deal a while ago, and my first book, The Serial Killer Next Door, will be out September the 5th, 2024. I'm going to leave links below, so if you want to pre-order and get your hands on one of those, then the links are there. I want to say a massive thank you to all of you, because the truth is, I wouldn't have done it unless you guys have motivated me to do so. It's one of those things that I can't quite believe has happened. I can't believe that you guys have been so supportive here either. So if any of you want to catch me at theatres in the UK doing the Serial Killer Next Door tour, or in fact Killer Cults as well, I'm out there doing that as well, or you want to reserve the book, follow the links below. Let's talk about today's case. Today's case is one of those where you just take a breath, because it makes you recognise that you can be living your life. To all intents and purposes, everybody thinks you're happy. You seem to have a great relationship with your partner. You seem to have a relatively idyllic experience, and you have no idea what is going on in the minds of those around you. It's a stark reminder of how we only ever truly live our own lives in our own movies, directing our own world. We can never ultimately understand the characters around us. We're not in control of those. And the case of Jamie Faith absolutely illustrates this to a T. And it's one of those cases where you will literally throughout be saying, why? How? What on earth? Because there is literally no graduation or escalation to where we're going to end up. It is something that is so unusual and that seemingly was so unnecessary that it makes you question everything. So let's talk about the victim, Jamie Faith. Jamie Faith, I will tell you now, is regarded by everybody who knew him as just one of the loveliest souls known. Literally. Colleagues, friends, neighbours, everybody. Stepdaughter, the whole caboodle. They all think that Jamie was somebody who was very, very special. He was born on the 11th of May, 1971. He was born in Wisconsin. He was bright academically. He was somebody who in 1994 graduated from the University of Wisconsin, but he actually graduated in computer science. He was really intelligent. He loved working with computers. And back in the 90s, we're talking about a time where it is very much at the beginning of the boom in computer coding and in the arena itself. And of course, with that comes the opportunity to do very well in your work because you were at the forefront of technology. He adored working with computers. He was apparently a massive fan of the Green Bay Packers. He loved bowling, he loved playing pool, and he was just described by friends, quote, as one of those guys you would want to be neighbors with. And in fact, neighbors that used to live next door to him up until pretty much close to his death, they said that he was one of those human beings that was really open with the friendship, and they even had a pool in the backyard and they would let the neighbor's children go and play in the backyard. One of the neighbors had adopted 7 children and basically they allowed their home to be open to them. And that was Jamie's wife as well. She also encouraged those children to come round. But it does say something really wholesome about the household, doesn't it? About Jamie himself, who's inviting people round to use the pool, and also with his partner, his wife, who is encouraging that behavior as well. Now, people who knew Jamie said he was just that all round good, dependable, and really nice guy. Didn't offend anybody, wasn't somebody who was problematic. didn't have a drinking issue, didn't have a drug dependency issue, didn't have a conflict issue with the neighborhood. He was just the kind of individual you'd want to spend time with, work with as a colleague, and be friends with. We get to October 2005. And at this point, Jamie actually meets his future wife, Jennifer. They meet each other on a blind date, and apparently they click literally instantly. People who knew the couple early on, they said they were genuinely the perfect match. In fact, people referred to them as two peas in a pod. So incredibly compatible. Now, Jennifer had a bit more of a pitted relationship in her past. So she had two previous ex-husbands and a daughter, Amber, and she was 8 years of age when they met. Now, I'm not gonna judge Jennifer too harshly. People have relationships, they break down and they move on. But when you're dealing at quite a young age of having two previous marriages, it does say something about your sticking power. And sometimes, I'm not saying everybody, there'll be people out there who've had lots of marriages and genuinely have found their perfect partner and are living happily forever for the rest of their lives. But there are certain people who like things to be interesting. They like things to have a little bit of excitement. And they get carried away by the way it feels at the very beginning of a relationship. And they imagine that that should be how it feels throughout the relationship. And of course, inevitably, they're highly disappointed because great relationships, as we know, are about paying the bills together and hopefully liking each other enough for most of the time to not leave one another. Because relationships, no matter how great they are, go through periods of being a bit dull and also a bit stressful because essentially life can be those things. So arguably, it could be that the reason Jennifer has had two previous ex-husbands is because she doesn't have a lot of staying power when it comes down to relationships, and she potentially likes the excitement of those early days. So she has this little girl called Amber. She's 8 years of age when she meets Jamie, and Jamie hadn't actually wanted children of his own, but when he met Jennifer and he met her daughter, Amber, he became really supportive of her. Apparently, he really stepped up to the role of being a dad, and he literally attended all her dance classes. And that says something about a man who had an idea that he wanted his life to be a particular way. And we've got to look at the fact that he comes from a computer science background. He probably is at times more interested in things than people. We see that in engineering as well. It isn't that they don't absolutely love and adore the people around them, it's just they have such a keen interest in a particular arena that they put a lot of their energy into that. So when they get into relationships, sometimes they're not thinking about the family dynamic, having children, purely on the basis because they are committed to a particular role. In this case, he was very committed to his career. But then the moment they recognize the joy that children bring, and they're suddenly in a situation where they have access to the wonder of what a child really is in their world and how it impacts on their world, everything shifts. And he fully commits to Amber. He adores her. And again, he's a step-parent. And we also have to acknowledge that he isn't somebody who just accepts that there is a child involved in the picture. He sees this as an absolute benefit to his life, and it helps him thrive in his world. And in 2012, the couple get married. They get married in Las Vegas. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you take the opportunity to have somebody like Elvis marry you? Just throwing it out there. Now, in 2015, this is when Amber has now reached the age of 18 years of age. So he's obviously been in Amber's life for a decade. She actually asks Jamie to adopt her, and he's really honored to do that. He loved her as his own daughter, as his own flesh and blood. And he was really, really made up that she wanted to do this. And I think that, again, it speaks volumes. The very fact that Amber sees him as the father in her world. Because obviously she has a biological father, but he is the person that, as far as she is concerned, has turned up and shown up and been present and been loving and been a role model and mentor to her. And I imagine for Jamie that is such an ultimate honour, an ultimate privilege, because when you see a child choosing you, and choosing you when they are turning an adult, because you have been such a mark of meaning in their life, it demonstrates the character that Jamie is, because she didn't need to do that. She did it because he'd earned it. He had earned that position. Now, Jennifer, Jamie's wife, she'd worked in healthcare administration. She'd also worked as a speech therapist. And Jamie had worked in the IT department at American Airlines in Arizona. But in 2017, Jamie received a really good promotion. And the promotion was he was going to become a senior manager when American Airlines acquired US Airways. And that meant that the family relocated to Dallas, Texas for this position. But ultimately, he's doing really well. Now we get to October the 8th, 2020. Bear in mind, on October the 8th, 2020, this is just before his murder, the couple celebrate 15 years together. So they have been a solid couple for 15 years. As noted, peas in a pod. People were envious of their connection and compatibility. They were a great couple. And yet, it all comes to an end. In the most horrific of ways, because on the morning of October the 9th, 2020, this is around 7:30 a.m., Jamie and Jennifer just go out for a walk with their dog Maggie, as they would do, taking the dog out. And yet, just minutes after they've left the home, from nowhere, a masked man comes up behind them. This masked man points a gun at Jamie, fires 9 times. 7 of those bullets hit Jamie, 3 of them in the head, 3 of them in the chest, and 1 in his groin. The man then goes for Jennifer, tackles her to the ground. She obviously is trying to run away. There's some horrifically terrifying masked man who's just basically executed her husband on the spot, and now he's after her. Then he gets her, he uses duct tape to tie her hands together, and he's apparently trying at this point to steal her rings. He also takes Jamie's wedding ring, and then he just goes. He flees in his black truck. Now, bear in mind, this is really early in the morning when people are getting ready for work, and understandably, the noise that's occurring draws attention from the neighbors. First of all, when you hear bullet shots like that in quick succession, you're immediately going to be thinking, what the hell's happening? So many of the neighbors called 911. And emergency services do get there quickly, but in spite of the fact that they arrive there very quickly, unfortunately, there's nothing that they can do for Jamie. He's pronounced dead at the scene outside his home. And it's quite unsettling, but you actually have pictures from his own doorbell, his video doorbell, which captures him and Jennifer leaving the home to go walking that dog. And there's something just so extraordinary, isn't there, about those moments? It's extraordinary that somebody can just go about their daily routine, they're happily going about their business, they're probably thinking about what's going to happen at the office that day, or they're thinking about a birthday they might be attending, and they have absolutely no idea that this will be the last thoughts that they're engaging with because they're going to be killed. And that's exactly what happened for Jamie on that day. Now, Jennifer, when she's questioned by the authorities, is struggling to talk about, firstly, who the assailant is, because the description of the assailant is problematic. He'd worn a blue mask over his mouth and over his nose. She basically said that she knew that he had dark eyes. Now, they also had a description of his actual vehicle because it had been captured on neighbors' security cameras, and it was basically a black Nissan Titan. And one of the things that stuck out about the Nissan Titan was that there was a T sticker on the rear window. So that was an identifying feature of this particular black Nissan. And they're a bit confused with respect. The investigators who are looking at this, they're used to dealing with homicides, of course. It's a sad reality of what police officers have to do. But even though you can't say there's always a pattern to the way that somebody is murdered and the reasons behind why they are murdered, what you definitely don't expect is somebody like Jamie to end up being executed in the way that he's been executed. It is not a formula they expect to see because it's clearly planned and premeditated. So they start thinking, well, could it be that maybe the actual plan was to abduct Jennifer because they were putting duct tape around her. Maybe that was the intention and he got spooked and therefore didn't go ahead with it. You know, he killed the male so the male couldn't fight as he took Jennifer. But there was still this idea, well, why didn't he take her then? And it was so strange that the murder was so brutal. It had occurred in the early hours of the morning where people were around, and it wasn't as if the attacker had actually tried to steal anything from them. Yes, the rings, etc. But there was nothing necessarily obvious that the person was trying to get. Now, at this point, police genuinely didn't have any suspects, and figuring out what the motivation could be to actually kill a man who, to all intents and purposes, never provoked any negative realities from anybody was confusing. But what they do know is when you look at an attack like this, this is personal. This is savage. The amount of shots fired, the areas the shots were fired, even one in his groin, just psychologically consider the reasoning why somebody might shoot you in your groin. It says something about feeling. One could argue, well, it could just be a rogue bullet went there instead of the head and chest, etc. But it could also be very calculated. When somebody has taken the time to disguise themselves, to probably lie in wait, and then to basically execute you in broad daylight in cold blood, and to shoot you savagely in areas that were designed to kill, but also to hit you in the groin, does that say something about the motivations of the person and the way that they feel about the person that they are killing? And CCTV footage from Jamie Faith's household, as I said, showed not only them leaving the house, going for that walk, but it also showed a man watching the house. There was a man seen from the garden next door, 2:30 a.m. before the murders, watching the house. So the authorities know this attack was absolutely planned. Now, obviously, they need to bring to justice whoever this killer is. I mean, it's terrifying. Nobody wants a man like this on the loose. Nobody wants to believe that you can be just walking the dog in broad daylight and you can be killed in cold blood. And also that the threat may be to another female, because Jennifer had found herself covered in duct tape. Maybe this person had literally planned to take her and do horrible things to her as well. So everybody wants to know about what's going on. And Jennifer gets involved in televised interviews, and she's just appealing and pleading for information. She talked about Jamie, as we would expect, because let's be honest, he was an amazing guy. She said that he was her best friend. She said he was so caring. He was so kind. Even described the fact that he was the kind of human being that would literally give you the shirt off his back.
I just hope that at some point, maybe this person can recognize the gravity of what they've done.
Also, a $25,000 reward was put up for information about the crime. So hopefully motivating people who may have information or might know the killer to come forward, because they're obviously going to benefit financially. Now, when it comes down to crimes like this, I'm just going to throw it out there. I don't think any of us are struggling to think about the direction we'd be looking at when it comes down to the investigators' mindsets. We're talking about a man in a lovely job with a lovely family, to all intents and purposes with no enemies, and in a situation where he's been killed in a highly unusual way. In fact, he's been executed. And unless Jamie has in the background got involved with the mob and nobody realizes and has found himself falling foul of such a gang reality, this kind of murder just doesn't play out. Organized hits don't tend to be orchestrated by anybody else than people close to the individual who's murdered. So it doesn't take Sherlock Holmes very long to think, probably just going to ask whether Jennifer, his wife, might have had, I don't know, anything to do with it. Maybe we should just, I don't know. I'm not saying she definitely did it, because obviously it could just be something really unusual and very different to any crimes that we've ever seen before in this situation. But we should definitely check. Let's just go with the stereotype and imagine that potentially she may have had some involvement in her husband's demise. So the police start looking through Jennifer's phone records to see whether there is indeed anything incriminating. And initially, they don't really find very much until they come across a text to one of her friends, which reveals that she's been talking with an ex-boyfriend. This is a guy called Darren Lopez. He's 51 years of age at the time. They'd been high school sweethearts and they'd actually split up because he was deployed to South Korea. Now, he'd since served 26 years in the Special Forces, and during that period of time, he had sadly suffered a traumatic brain injury. He'd been a Green Beret, So obviously very dedicated, very patriotic, and also deeply protective as a human being. Also have to acknowledge a traumatic brain injury is not an enviable reality. It can affect the person in a multitude of different ways. Also just to acknowledge that when you have a high school sweetheart and then life gets in the way and you don't play out the relationship you ideally thought you might have, you can have a real residual connection with that person. I think anybody who has ever reconnected with somebody that they have a shared history with, even when there has been a huge gap in between who they were then and who they are now, you can have these really lovely feelings and loving feelings towards them because you remember who they were. Not who they are, but who they were. And also, a memory is a memory of a memory, and so on and so forth. So you often build pictures around possibilities, and that's why we have seen, when Facebook happened, lots of sudden divorces because people who were in their 40s were connecting with people they hadn't seen since they were 15 and then being like, hey, maybe I should have been with you. And then ending the relationship with their current partner to go and reclaim history, so to speak. Not saying it worked out, probably didn't, because you're not the same person you were, but it means that you have built up an idea of who this human being could have been in your world. And also rose-colored spectacles. Very often, you're just seeing the very best of who they were back then. So when these two connect, and that's what happens, he makes contact with Jennifer in March of the year after he'd retired, he is probably thinking about what could have been, and also probably wanting to reconnect with friends because he's obviously been in the forces for a long time and probably wants to create new alliances with people who he used to know. But he's also recently divorced. So he's free to talk to other women. And like I said, if he's lonely and he's thinking about romance, it might be that just reflecting on what used to be with her brought positive memories. And that's why he reaches out. So at this point, the investigators are like, she's in contact with this man, and this man is somebody who knows how to kill. Let's just put it out there. That's the reality. He's a trained killer, and he has to be. And we need people like him because they're who keep us safe. But ultimately, when somebody's been executed in broad daylight and they know there's this connection, well, arguably, they'll recognize that he would be somebody who would know how to use a gun in a way that has been used in this case. So they look to Darren and they're concerned that potentially there is a link. So at this point, they find out where he lived and they look on aerial footage of his home. And the first thing that stands out really obviously is that his truck matches the description of the murderers. So that in itself shows a link between the wife of the man who's been murdered and an individual that she's been communicating with. So it's at this point they think they've got their guy and they basically begin to build a case against Darren. And the way they do that is they look at his bank and his phone records. And again, it's really incriminating. So they're able to determine that he'd traveled from his home in Tennessee to Dallas on the day of the murder. Now, that had been a 650-mile journey, and they were able to see that he'd arrived before 2:30 in the morning, and then he'd waited for them to basically leave the house. So as far as they're concerned, he is bang to rights. They know they've got the guy. So we get to the 11th of January 2021. At this point, Darren is arrested, and his house and his truck get searched, and wow, there is just an absolute plethora, a plethora, an abundance of incriminating evidence that is discovered. So first of all, the mask, and that mask was basically similar to the description of the one which the attacker had been wearing. Credit cards, and those credit cards were in Jennifer's name, and also the murder weapon, which was a 45 caliber handgun. So they have literally everything they need to pin this crime on him. Now, after they arrest Darren, they then interview Jennifer because, understandably, they're like, it feels a little bit weird that the killer is somebody that Jennifer has had contact with. It feels a little bit odd that there is that common feature. And they started to feel that there's a significant possibility that she's been involved in the murder of her husband, which would make sense. Because no matter what Darren's feelings are, the likelihood of him doing this, because he's motivated by his feelings for Jennifer and that she has no involvement in that reflection of feelings, would be very unusual. Now, Jennifer at this point says, look, I'm going to be honest. Me and Darren, we have been frequently texting each day. I've deleted the messages off my phone. We didn't actually have a sexual affair at all, but when they find the messages, because Darren hadn't deleted any of the messages, even though she's telling the truth, they haven't actually had a sexual affair physically, it's absolutely 100% evident from the messages that they had an emotional affair. That was going on. And the psychological reality of an emotional affair when you're in a relationship, it's still adulterous. You don't have to have physical contact to have a relationship with somebody. Even if you're in a scenario where you're in an unhappy situation with your partner, speaking to another party and investing emotionally in that other party, it is an adulterous reality. Like I said, the sexual element is one stage further, but your energies and your emotional relationship is being directed in a place that's not appropriate when you are in a relationship. I know we're all human and we all make mistakes, but like I said, she's investing elsewhere. Also, they've been sexting, which is one step further from talking about feelings. It's literally doing something that absolutely denotes that the connection between you is moving and escalating to a more sexual place.
Around, and I just saw this person shoot and
Several shots.
Well, a lot of shots. Six, five, six, maybe, I feel like. Mm-hmm. And he just kept going. And I'm like, what is this stopping?
He said, his, your husband's facial expression.
Just like, the light, come on.
Now, Darren, as I said, hadn't got rid of the messages between himself and Jennifer, which was good because it meant that they were able to see just how intense the pair were. There was over 116,000 texts between the pair. 116,000. I don't think I have 116,000 texts between myself and my husband that I've been with for over a decade. I genuinely cannot comprehend having the time. I mean, who has that amount? Who has time for 116,000 texts in a short period of time? Now, when Jennifer finds out that the police are looking at these things, and she's also made aware, of course, of the descriptor of the vehicle, bear in mind that the truck that was seen had this T sticker. When they're going through these messages and she'd become aware, she'd actually texted him and said, I woke up in a bit of a panic. Something's eating away at me, telling me that you need to take the sticker out of the back window of the truck. She went on to say, I don't normally overreact like this. I really think you need to get that sticker off ASAP, like today. And when she got a reply from him saying that he'd removed the sticker, she replied, oh yay, I feel so much better. Really? So basically, you've sent the guy who they believe has executed your husband And you've informed him that what he needs to do is change the way that his vehicle looks, because the likelihood is that the authorities are coming for him. And firstly, you don't think that that might be incriminating, because it always stuns me when people contact each other using technology and think they're just going to be able to get away with murder. Because the first thing that the authorities always do is literally do a sweep of all of your technological items, like laptops, your phones, etc., because they are going to dig deep. And yet these individuals regularly communicate in a way that absolutely denotes guilt. But not only is she suggesting that he needs to change that sticker, she's also automatically thinking that it resolves it. Honestly, we could have been in so much trouble. You and I, Darren, we could have been in so much trouble. But you know what? It's okay. Because the only way they were ever going to pin this crime on you, and then ultimately me, is because of that sticker. So, whew, don't have to worry about it. 116,000 text messages is not an issue. Just that particular sticker needed to come off the car. But yeah, that's how unsophisticated she is. And bear in mind as well, the psychology of the way the crime played out is that she's the victim too. Bear that in mind. When this man, who so many people loved, when Jamie was executed in daylight, in such a horrific, heinous manner, she had duct tape put on her. She was also granted victim status. So she will have been playing to this. In the interviews with the neighbours, she wants people to feel sorry for her. And yet now we're finding that actually there is a strong likelihood this woman has orchestrated an attack, a brutal execution of a man who literally was asked by her own daughter to be the adopted father because he is such a good human being. And she is only concerned about keeping Darren from the authorities by removing that sticker and feeling good about the fact that she feels that she's potentially achieved that because he acted on that suggestion. Also, there's another shocking twist in the case, because as the investigators start to look at the text messages, they're trying to figure out what's going on in the relationship between Jennifer and Jamie, because understandably, relationships can be very different behind closed doors. You can have two peas in a pod as far as people acknowledge when you're out there, but then horrible things can happen behind closed doors. We see that all the time. So they want to see, were there problems in the relationship with Jennifer and Jamie? Is there anything untoward going on? And so they're looking at all the different players within that. And when they're reading the text messages between Jennifer and Darren, well, let's just say she starts to talk about some pretty disturbing and dark stuff. So she says that Jamie was very physically abusive towards her, was very sexually abusive towards her. And bear that in mind when you consider the fact that one of the bullets went through Jamie's groin. Like I said, ultimately, it could just be one of the areas that was shot randomly. But to me, it speaks of something that is much more motivated by a rage towards the individual on a sexual level. So purposefully hitting that very male area and literally causing more damage than is required to kill. So it's complete overkill, but also sending a message. As the perpetrator, you're sending a message about the way you feel towards that person's potential sexual regions. And here we have Jennifer giving Darren a reason to feel very, very hostile towards Jamie because apparently he's sexually abusing her. And it was found out that Darren had received loads of emails, and some of those emails were apparently from Jamie. And the emails from Jamie were really threatening in nature. So he was saying that he knew about the affair. He was saying that if he didn't stop, then he was basically going to abuse Jennifer. So now Darren's got this actual evidence because he's got this interaction with Jamie, who's being an abuser, who's sexually abusing Jennifer, who's threatening Jennifer. And now he's saying, listen, you dare to carry on this relationship with this woman that you've obviously now got feelings for, I'm going to hurt her more. So Darren is going to be feeling really concerned about Jennifer's well-being. He's going to be a responsible party as well, because part of the failure to protect is because of the fact that he can't be present to protect her on one level, but also his actions in having a relationship with her means that there's a failure to protect her because it's leading potentially to this abuse. There were also other emails from Jennifer's friend Rob. Now, Jennifer's friend Rob informed Darren that they were watching the abuse and it was awful. It was just getting worse and worse. And he even sent photos of the injuries that Jamie had basically inflicted on Jennifer. So bear this in mind. We've got Darren, who's now being told directly by Jennifer, her life is horrific. She's in danger. She's being sexually and physically abused. Her friend Rob is literally sending evidence, photographs of the injuries that she's sustained. And we also have Jamie getting in contact with Darren saying, if you don't leave my wife alone, there are going to be consequences for her. Now, Darren, at this point, when all these messages are coming and emails are coming, says to Jennifer, listen, you need to go to the police. You need to go to the police. You need to tell them about the alleged abuse. But her response to that is, I don't want to. I don't want Jamie to be arrested because Amber, my daughter, absolutely loves him. For Amber's sake, I do not want that to happen. Now, personally, just going to throw it out there. If you are being abused by a partner, sexually violated, physically violated, and you know that you have picture evidence, witness evidence, and you have the opportunity to be in a relationship with somebody who maybe is better, I'm not sure that you're going to care about the opinion of your daughter about this horrendous human being. And the reason for that is you'd want your daughter to know what a POS the stepdad was. I mean, who would want a kid, no matter what their age is, whether they're 8 or 18 or 48, who would want their kid around this kind of predator? They're not safe, are they? So personally, if somebody said to me, oh, I've told you all this information, it's really heinous what I'm going through. And I said, well, you need to speak to the police about that. And they were like, oh, I'm not going to do that because I really want to just make sure that their good reputation is still held in my daughter's opinion. I'd be like, they're lying. Honestly, sorry, does that make me sound really suspicious? No, it doesn't. It means I'm logical. If you know you are at risk, and you know that this person has got all of these malicious intentions and that they're dangerous and that you're under threat, the last thing you care about is whether your own physical, biological daughter has an opinion that's positive towards that individual. All you care about is getting the hell out and making sure that you are safe. Because Amber's not at risk. He's not threatening her. This is more about him being seen badly by Amber. Well, you'd want Amber to see him badly. But of course, on further investigation, it turns out the emails that Darren has been receiving, relentlessly receiving, they weren't from Jamie. They weren't from her friend Rob. Nope. Jennifer had created fake accounts where she pretended to be these individuals. All of the stuff that she was writing, all the claims that Jamie was abusing her, every single one of them was just lies. And the pictures that she sent, those pictures that were evidence of the physical abuse, they were just online stock images. Well, there were some that were photos of injuries that she'd sustained in a car accident that had happened a few years earlier, but essentially the rest was just stock footage. Put that into your minds for a moment. This woman is absolutely fabricating that the man that she is living with is sexually and physically, and no doubt emotionally, abusing her to such a degree that she has all this physical evidence and she's telling this man that she's in some kind of a emotional stroke sexting relationship who she's had a relationship with back in the day. And she's loading him up with this negativity about this human being that she's sharing a home with. And she's talking about how scared she is. And she's literally saying that she's getting sexually abused and she's being physically harmed. And all of it, all of that that she's been doing and saying is just fantasy. None of this has happened. Jamie isn't a monster. He's done absolutely nothing wrong. She is just creating a narrative where she is this victim, just like in the crime itself, where she has it orchestrated that she is the person who is also ultimately a victim because she is present when it occurs. She's a victim there. She's a victim in this fantasy. She's a victim. The attention's on her. And this is what she's doing. She's getting attention for herself through negative realities of impacting other people's lives with the information that she's giving them, such as with Darren, but also ultimately, which affects Jamie. Because bear in mind, Darren thinks that Jamie is a heinous monster. And she's invented friends to do this with. Rob is just an invention that she's created to validate and substantiate the crimes that she is suggesting that Jamie is carrying out. How does anybody start to create such a fantasy, such a dangerous fantasy, malevolent on so many levels? She is literally disrespecting Jamie on every level. She's putting him in the line of fire because Darren is ex-forces and obviously is highly protective as well of her and the relationship that they are having as far as he is concerned. And she's orchestrating and manipulating in such a way that she's becoming Darren's puppet master. So finally, on the 24th of February 2021, Jennifer is arrested. Now, initially, she's arrested for obstruction of justice, but then that's later changed because she's charged with murder for hire, which makes perfect sense. That's obviously what we're talking about right now. Now, bear in mind, when she's arrested, they have a lot of information that means they can do that, such as the fake email scam. And they know it's her because of the IP address, etc. She can't run away from it. She can't be like, oh, no, no. My friend Rob. Where's your friend Rob? My friend Rob sent them. Who is your friend Rob? My friend Rob. What's his address? My friend Rob and I, we only communicate by telepathy. Rob doesn't exist, does he? Just communicating with Rob now. And he says, you're wrong. He does exist. So there's no way she's going to be able to get away with it. They know that she was responsible. However, in spite of the fact that she's literally confessed at this point to the police that she sent the fake emails to Darren, she at the same time writes a note to Darren, and this note reads, just a quick note to say, I never lied to you and I never sent you emails from any account but mine as me. There's a ton more I wish I could say, but I can't right now. So what is that ton more that you want to say? There's just a ton more that I want to say. Does it involve admitting that what you've just said in the note is a massive amount of lies and that we have absolutely found out that you are responsible for all the fake emails? No, because even though I've confessed to you that I did write all those emails, what I'm saying is that I didn't write all those emails as far as where Darren is concerned. So are you saying that you did write the emails? I'm saying I did write the emails to you. But I'm saying that I didn't write the emails to Darren, and if only he knew a ton more of stuff, he'd realise that they were always from me. So all the emails were from you. They actually were all from me. So the fake ones were from you. Yes, I've said that to you. I'm confused. Yeah, that's because you are literally talking BS. But as you can see, that's the way that she works. Even in the line of fire, when she has been discovered, she can't acknowledge the truth. You can't break down the fantasy and just be like, okay, I absolutely lied to you. I am responsible for what's played out in party in line with you, because obviously Darren is also culpable of this crime. But the point is, she is the puppet master. It's delusional to think that somehow she can still keep up the pretense to Darren. She also forwarded another message saying, please tell him ASAP. I will always be his. I am with him. We'll always be with him, regardless of whatever has happened. Again, just going to throw it out there, probably not going to be with him. Probably going to be not with him, specifically because you orchestrated murdering your husband, which means that neither of you can ever be together ever, because somebody's dead and both of you are going to serve a hefty price for that in prison. You know, would have been miles easier if you just left the relationship and gone and been with him. But then, what we're talking about where Jennifer is concerned isn't even the relationship with Darren. It's the fantasy of it, isn't it? I mean, when it comes down to it, these two don't really have a relationship. They have a relationship based on what they've created in their heads and what she's created in her fantasy, but it's not real. And again, it just speaks of this woman who is living in a fantasy world without taking any responsibility or accountability for what's happened. Because let me tell you, and this is what it really boils down to. If you're in a relationship with somebody and Then you meet an extra party and you want to have a relationship with them. You're interested in them. Your feelings are lustful and they are beginning to feel as if your alliance in this place are now being directed to another place. In that circumstance and situation, if you say, I'm having a really bad time, I'm really unhappy in my relationship, I don't want to be with them, I want to be with you. And you're like, as the other party, great, well, I want to be with you too. And they're like, well, there's a problem because I've got this partner and obviously the reality is that I'm going to have to do something about them. Your response would be, leave them, get divorced, come be with me. If they then are like, well, I don't know whether I want to do it that way. And you're like, okay, well, how will we do this? Like, how do we be together? And they say, well, I've got this great idea. All you need to do is to execute my partner, kill them. At the point that that person goes, okay, I'll do that for you, you should be running in the other direction anyway. Anybody who agrees to actually go ahead and murder somebody for you is not a safe person to be around. It doesn't matter how your feelings are. It doesn't matter how deep they are. It doesn't matter what you believe your future could be. If somebody's like, yeah, okay, I'll just come and do that for you, run very fast in the opposite direction. So again, saying that she would want to be with him, she'd always be with him regardless of what has happened, means that again, she has absolutely no logic or common sense whatsoever, because this is a man who is quite capable of killing. And if you can kill one person, you can kill another when we're talking about the context we're talking about today. Now, bear in mind, before it actually comes to light that Jennifer is responsible for the murder plot, a lot of people in the local community are very sad. They're very upset for her because at the end of the day, she's a victim. So there's a GoFundMe. And this happens time and time again, doesn't it? I know that GoFundMes are great. I know that it does a lot of good. But it also does have the odd con artist here and there, doesn't it? So this GoFundMe is set up by a neighbour, and it's set up to basically give financial aid to her and Amber because there's been this tragedy. It's going to cost them a lot of money because clearly he's not going to be earning money anymore. There's going to be funeral costs and so on and so forth. And over $60,000 have been raised because people are good. You know, human beings get criticised a lot, but honestly, on the whole, we're really good. And when people are in need, we walk to the flames. We don't avoid them. So $60,000 has been raised. Shockingly, and yet not really, it's discovered that Jennifer actually just misused the money. So people have all donated this to her and Amber's future. And she's like, well, I could look after my daughter, Amber. I mean, after all, I wanted to protect her from knowing what a horrendous and heinous partner I had in her stepfather. So I actually had him executed to avoid her ever finding out that he was a terrible person. But even though now, because I care so deeply about her feelings, to do such a thing so that she didn't realise what a horrible person he was, I am not going to use the money to actually think about her future. Instead, I'm going to buy gifts for Darren. Yeah. So she takes the money and she buys Darren things like a large screen TV and lots of gifts. So Darren's getting a lot of congratulations for actually going ahead and doing the unthinkable. Now, thankfully, GoFundMe, because obviously they knew that people had been conned, they refunded the people who had been conned into donating to the cause when they were made aware of the situation. But what kind of a callous human being is Jennifer? I mean, talking about having no remorse is so demonstrated. We are talking about her benefiting from a man's death who deserved none of this and just showering the man who executed him in cold blood with all of these gifts. The egocentricity of Jennifer is just so enormous, isn't it? I know it's not Munchausen's by proxy in the typical sense, because clearly it's a murder for hire and her husband is murdered horribly on one occasion. There hasn't been a sustained period where he's been abused, but you can't help but think it fits into the factitious disorder category because of the fact that she is carving out this way of getting lots of attention for her own needs. And then ultimately, when somebody pays an enormous price in the context of Jamie, she then again benefits and is rewarded by this, by the sympathy and empathy of people around her. And then she uses the money that's garnered from that to actually shower her new partner, or whatever you would call him, with all these gifts. So again, getting lots of positive strokes and rewards in that context without any care or compassion for the damage that she's caused. And she has no remorse, it's obvious. You know, to spend well-intentioned people's money on presents for the murderer is unthinkable. It's unbelievable that she had the audacity to do that. Bear in mind, the level of betrayal that her friends and family would have added to this situation when they found out. I mean, they're already going to feel betrayed that she actually went ahead and had this lovely man killed. But then to find out that the spoils from the crime were spent on the man who killed him, it's just deceit beyond reason. It also emerged that 1 month after Jamie's murder, Jennifer actually attempted to claim $629,000 in life insurance. Of course she did. Of course she did. Those big TVs, she's going to need to be buying more of them. There's going to be some cars, some holidays, maybe another wedding in Las Vegas to add to the other weddings. You know, she is absolutely thinking about what she's going to have for herself and Darren. She has no care, compassion, concern, or consequence when it comes down to what she has actually achieved, which is the brutal execution of a man that loved her. Because let's bear that in mind. Jamie loved her. On February the 7th, 2022, Jennifer did actually plead guilty. Now, it was requested that the death penalty wouldn't be sought if she made a guilty plea, and that the obstruction of justice charges would be dropped. So basically, prosecutors sought a life sentence for murder for hire. The US attorney, Chad Meacham, said that Jennifer had put on quite a performance to the public while she'd been orchestrating her cover-up. So that was absolutely what she did. Ultimately, she stood in front of those cameras and acted like the grieving widow. And he said, despite this, crocodile tears didn't stop the feds, who were basically committed to getting justice for Jamie. Judge Jane Boyle said that Jennifer was, quote, didn't mince the words, pure evil. And she indeed sentenced her to life in prison. She was also told to pay $6,500 in restitution to Jamie's family, and also a $250,000 fine on top of this. Now, Darren's trial, that took place in July 2023. Darren was charged with the murder of Jamie and also for gun crime. Now, he spoke in his own defense. He said that he was literally devastated. He was utterly blindsided and broken when he realised that Jennifer had manipulated him, that she'd made up all of the claims that Jamie was abusive when he was actually a really innocent and a really good man. And Jennifer had basically told him and kept reinforcing that the only way that she would be safe from Jamie is if he was killed. So he was basically using as his defence the fact that he genuinely believed that the only way that she was ever going to be safe is if Jamie was taken away from this planet for eternity. And again, I get it. When it comes down to battered wife syndrome and battered partner syndrome, when it comes down to the point where certain people in highly abusive relationships think that no matter what they do, if they leave, that person will always come for them. That's why ultimately some people have not been given murder sentences when they have killed their partners. But that's not what we're talking about here. So if she is in such grave danger, with respect, Darren could just call the police. Like, he's been in the armed forces. At the end of the day, he is somebody that served his country for a long period of time. Don't act as if there was only one way forward. But that's the defense. So he said that he had to kill him, otherwise something terrible would have happened to her. So this is when they get together and they devise the plan to murder him. He said that he had driven to Dallas in military mode, and he believed genuinely at his heart that he was on a mission to rescue Jennifer and Amber. He said, at the time, I was thinking I was the noble soldier that did my job. I did what I was trained to do. I protected people. I kept them from a monster. Well, yeah and no. I mean, you're genuinely trained to do what you did, as in to kill, but you're trained to kill in just circumstances. And I know, is it ever just to kill? But we appreciate that those in the forces, they have to do things that none of us would wish to do to serve and protect their country. And at times, unfortunately, that means killing other people. But not civilians, even though that happens in war, it shouldn't, it does. But not civilians on the street when you're not even in the forces, come on. He was never trained to kill people because a partner doesn't feel that they like that partner anymore and they're saying that they're being abused. That's a complete overreach. And no matter how much of a puppet master that she was, he is still going ahead and doing the unthinkable. Now, when he was asked to describe the murder, Darren said that he'd shot Jamie in the head, as he really thought he was a monster at the time. And even though he did believe what she'd told him about Jamie, he also didn't want him to suffer. So that's why he'd shot him in the way that he had. He wanted to kill him, not to leave him with horrific injuries that would take time for him to die. His defense attorneys, they said that Darren had been duped and that Jennifer had literally created all the information that had led to him believing it was true, that she created a monster and then sent Darren, who's this disabled soldier, to do her bidding. He said, as his defense attorney, that he pulled the trigger, but she pulled him. Now, I do appreciate that he wouldn't have driven to that place and murdered Jamie if she hadn't done all of that work. But come on, are we really arguing that it's acceptable on any level to do what he did? People say stuff about individuals they don't like or that they've had enough of all the time. And we hear things that people do that aren't very nice to people that we care about. We don't load up a truck, drive over somewhere, and then execute them in broad daylight. That is beyond the realms of reason. And also, you have to acknowledge that Darren is in a relationship to some degree with this woman. Is he just motivated by protection? Or is he also motivated by gain? He wants to be with her. They get rid of this man. They get money from his inheritance and his life insurance, and all of a sudden they can go on their merry way. Ultimately, that folie à deux is what's occurred. It's two people sharing the same delusion and going ahead and acting upon it. Now, the prosecution understandably argued that Darren was an active participant in the murder, that there had been options he'd chosen not to take. So first of all, it was noted that he hadn't taken any steps to ensure that Jennifer and her daughter were actually safe. So he didn't know whether they were actually in a position of danger or otherwise. He hadn't gone out of his way to figure that out. He hadn't turned up, because he could have. At the end of the day, this is a guy who's well-trained. He could have gone to Jamie's house. He's getting these apparent messages that are threatening him, and he could have challenged him. And the chances are, a computer science individual is not going to be the kind of guy who's going to be able to manage physically somebody who's trained in the way that Darren is. He's going to be no match. Jamie would struggle in that situation. But Darren doesn't do that. Nor had he actually confirmed that the abuse was actually occurring. He just accepted it. They said, and I believe they said rightfully so, that it was absurd for him to try to justify the murder in this way when it had certainly not been his only option. Genuinely, if you were sending me emails evidencing your injuries, telling me that your life was at risk, and I wasn't in your locality, I was going to walk in a police station and be like, man, this is happening to my friend. Let's do something about this. That's all that needed to happen. That is the only thing that needed to happen. All that he needed to do was walk into a police station with the evidence that had been sent to him by her and by apparently her friend Rob and by the husband in this situation, Jamie, threatening that he's going to abuse his wife if the relationship between Darren and her continues. Present that to the front desk and then let the authorities manage it, because you know what would have happened. They'd have gone around. Jamie would have been confronted. She would have been asked questions about it. This would all have been brought into the open. There is no way that the first option should be, oh, well, let's kill him. Let's kill him. Let's just concoct a plan and kill him. There should have been so many options before that. And the idea that he took that as his only option is despicable. Now, I understand that's more complex because of the traumatic brain injury. I would not reject the fact that his impulse control to some degree would be impacted potentially by that injury. I would not suggest that his personality may not have changed because of that injury. But again, it's not like it just happened out of the blue. At the end of the day, he had a lot of time to think about what he was doing on that incredibly long journey driving to Jamie's home to kill him. He had a lot of time to think about it from 2:30 in the morning to when Jamie and Jennifer left their home at 7:30 a.m. So we're not talking about somebody who had an immediate loss of control because they were so rageful about somebody that they loved being treated in a terrible manner. No. And also, you know, he was pretty happy to get all the gifts off her, wasn't he? Pretty happy to be able to spend the money that she was giving him. That certainly doesn't sound like somebody who was just motivated purely by a passionate feeling of protection towards this woman. But again, it's a more complex case than when it comes down jury-wise. If you're in a situation with somebody like Jennifer, then you are with somebody like Darren. And they do initially struggle to reach a unanimous decision. In the end, Darren was sentenced to 62 years in prison. He will be eligible for parole after 31 years. In an interview that was done with Darren, he later said that he genuinely believed that he was saving Jennifer and Amber from abuse, and that he was made to think that if he didn't act, Jennifer would end up being killed. He said, "The thought never entered my mind that she could use me this way." He said that he believed that she loved him, but now understands that he became her weapon. Now, like I say, in this situation, I do understand why Darren is peddling that belief system that somehow Jennifer is the puppet master and he was this helpless person just doing the best he could for somebody that he was in love with. I don't buy it. If that's the way the world worked, my God, it would be a dangerous place and space for all of us, because we all harbor resentment. We all sometimes think things about somebody and wish that something bad could happen to them. And the idea that we could just haphazardly allow somebody to go and do our bidding because it suits us, and for that person to somehow be innocent when it turns out that we were just a really nasty person who didn't get our way and wanted something terrible to happen to another human being, the world would be full of dead bodies far more than turn up in this day and age. Darren needs to take full responsibility and accountability for his actions, because the only victim in this, the only victim, is Jamie. When it comes down to Darren, guilty as hell. When it comes down to Jennifer, guilty as hell. Jamie was a lovely human being who just took his dog for a walk and was executed in broad daylight. And of course, his stepdaughter, who he adopted, she's also a victim, as is the wider family and friends. They were all duped. But let's not, in this story, pretend that Jennifer was some sophisticated, malevolent mastermind of the highest order who just pulled the strings and Darren did her bidding. He essentially benefited. He benefited financially, he benefited emotionally, and if they'd gone away with it, he would have benefited even more. When it comes down to the bare bones of this, a woman asked a man to kill another man. He said yes, and now they are both rightfully paying for that crime. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.